Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Thank you for having us in your offices.
This is very exciting for me.
Offices. That's very grown up.
It's so corporate. We have such a selection of sweatshirts on the wall.
What's with all those sweatshirts in the corner?
They are all...
That was from a bit?
It was. We had a special. We had a Christmas special.
Yeah.
And we sold the sweatshirts to benefit this organization that does social services for...
Right.
Migrant families. They're actually very attractive sweatshirts, and you should all take one.
Sure. Well, we'll pay for them to give it, you know, for a good cause.
I'll just pocket that money. No. I know. Oh, my God. This is the most hideous room.
It's
lovely. I forced you to do a podcast in the worst looking room.
On audio, it looks beautiful.
Okay, good.
Yeah. It's the most beautiful room you can imagine.
I hope so.
How's the sound check doing? Are we good? Are we ready to go?
David Tennant does a podcast with
Samantha Bee.
Well, Samantha, thank you very much for having us in your offices.
Thank you.
It's very quiet here.
It's quiet.
I thought it would be, you know, you're sort of, as you come towards Wednesday night, I thought people were running up and down corridors waving pieces of paper, importantly.
Well, you always think that a comedy room is going to be like basketball hoops and people are just like doing pinball.
Yeah.
But we don't have a show. We don't have a show this week. We have a show
next
week.
Oh, you don't have one this week?
Yeah, no. So this is a period of slow return to work and
I see.
Reflection about the future.
Okay. Yeah.
It was always we had a long break and then we tried to make the break ever so much longer by not working or thinking too hard. So now we're back in thinking.
I imagine a show like this, the approaching deadline is kind of the impetus for getting stuff done.
Yes, we're all last minute people on some level. We are all those kind of, you know, we cram for exams here.
Right.
So we do it all.
So February 2016, the first full episode of Full Frontal goes out.
Yes.
3 years later, the world, I'd say, and the US in particular, is in a very different place.
Yes.
But all the stuff that's happened in the interim, it's particularly fertile ground, one would have to say, for a political satirist. Are you conflicted by the fact that all the shit that's going on gives you loads of material?
No, it's terrible. This is a terrible situation. When we started in February of 2016, everything was so fun.
Yeah.
And Ben Carson was getting lost backstage and he couldn't find his luggage and Donald Trump was a candidate and that's just ridiculous
that's
on
hilarious.
Its face.
That was
so
just a punchline in itself.
So dumb.
Yeah.
And then really everything changed in November and you could really feel it.
Was there any part of you that on election night 2016 was thinking this is a bloodbath for the country, but oh my goodness, the stuff we're going to get out of this?
Well, actually, there was no part of me that felt that way. I felt that way in the election cycle leading up to the election.
Right.
I definitely was praising Satan every day for the beautiful bounty, the cornucopia of delights that he was providing us with. But on actual election night, it was something that is so bad. Can I say it?
You can say whatever you like.
Oh, my God. I was following stuff on Twitter. You know, we were following social media and we were slowly descending into hell, like personal hell on election night as the results were coming in. And someone sent me a photograph of myself like hanging from a tree dead. And I thought, oh, my God, like my social media started to fill up with the most insane messages from people who had hated the show all along but never reached out. And suddenly it was a tidal wave of imagery and horrendous language in my social media feel. And I felt like...
Oh, you mean gloating?
Gloating.
That we
it was
right
so, yes,
wrong.
Yes.
See.
It was so negative. And I really felt in that moment that there was a danger or the air was so toxic. It was really thick. And I thought, this is a whole new, you know, it's one thing to talk about a presidential candidate in a humorous way. It's one thing to do like, oh, you're going to take a poop in the Potomac. Like, ha 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 ha. But it's quite a different matter to speak about a president that way, or that is uncharted territory.
So much in some way. Right now.
Like we had George W. But I mean, obviously he was a disaster too. But this was felt like such an impending, even bigger disaster. It was the Hindenburg for sure.
And did you? Because obviously you're following as part of your job. You're following the news forensically.
Yes. Yes.
Did you not see it coming?
I, you know, people now upon reflection are telling me that I did see it coming,
right.
But I buried that in my soul. There was a period of time I did a whole bunch of shooting in Pennsylvania. We did a bus tour of Pennsylvania. Yeah. We were interviewing people and I didn't meet in the entire state. And I talked to a lot of people and I didn't meet a single human being from any walk of life who would say that they were voting for Hillary Clinton. And everybody reminds me that I came home from that trip and said, I think we are in trouble here. This feels very bad. And then I forgot about that. But my husband called it from the very beginning.
Did
he
really?
Knew, and he would go to parties and people would talk about it in that kind of like, oh, could you even imagine that Donald Trump will be president? He was like, get used to it. Say it. Say it out loud, President Donald Trump.
And why
did
he
say it a lot?
Why did he think? What was his?
He has a great. I don't know. He saw it. He saw it before anybody, and people really made fun of him. He was a pariah at dinner parties. Let me tell you.
Right.
People were not happy.
Just leave the Donald Trump stuff.
Oh my God, your husband's ridiculous, right? He's ruining our dinner party. But he was right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, get him out of here.
Yeah. I mean, in the sort of shitstorm that you're in, and we have it too back home.
Oh my God,
Brexit.
Of course you do. You guys are doing great.
We're doing great. Yeah,
everything's so smooth and easy.
Yeah,
where you are from,
we love it. We're so proud.
So fun.
But because we did it first,
I remember.
I came to the US a couple of times post Brexit, pre Trump, and people received you like, "You stupid! What is your country doing?"
So
openly
arrogant.
Laughing at us. Yeah,
you know.
Not that I wanted the books to be balanced, but it does feel a little bit like we all missed it. Right?
I think it's a cascading.
Yeah,
it's a cascading effect.
Is it hard to find balance in doing your show, or do you not even feel the need to?
I don't feel the need to.
Sure.
I'm solid.
Yeah.
I feel pretty good. I actually, we don't have, we're a comedy show, so we don't have access to anybody. No one will talk to us no matter what we do, so we don't have to abide by the same rules
as
everybody else.
We don't have any rules
We don't have to have those false equivalencies that exist everywhere else in the proper media. We don't have to pretend.
Right.
We can just, it's an opinion-based show, and it's a topical, opinion-based, angry show. I could say whatever I want within reason.
Yeah. So how do you keep plugged in? Because are you spending all day every day kind of waiting for the next story?
We are very plugged in. And if we're not, if we're not individually plugged in, the show is, everybody's watching. We're all
What
news
are you doing?
Junkies.
Is it Twitter? Is it cable news? Are you everything?
Some people
all
are
the
on
time?
Cable news. I don't watch cable news all the time. I think that would make me delirious.
Yeah.
That would cause great derangement. But there are people in the office who strictly watch cable news.
Because that's
we definitely.
Job?
Yeah, it's just a part of being aware of whatever everybody is saying out there. But it is easier now to receive their messaging in soundbite form, on social media. But we're always on social media all the time. I actually have had a very busy day, so I don't know what's happening in the world right now.
Right, because it happens fast right now.
It happens very fast.
Yeah.
It's 2 o'clock. Literally anything could have happened. I was just in a meeting for an hour. Maybe we're at war. I mean, probably.
Sure. So what is your news feed of choice?
I do love Twitter.
You do?
As a news feed. I do love it. I think it's great.
It's healthy. It's balanced.
It's healthy. It's
reasoned debate.
It's a calming influence. I don't personally participate in it too much, but I do appreciate that it is a constant streaming news source and source of just terrible aggravation. It's awful.
So you're an observer, brother. You don't get stuck in.
I don't get stuck in it. I don't. I turned all my notifications off. I do not get involved.
Okay.
I let people say whatever they want to say, and I don't. I don't care.
Does that take a force of will sometimes?
It does. You have to be very smart. You have to be very smart about it.
Yeah.
I'm very smart about it.
Do you have people who hide your phone?
I did have that. Actually, after Election Day, people took my phone away and they changed my Twitter password so that I couldn't see it. Yep.
Because it's quite a giddy time for someone who's into the news, who's following the news.
Yes.
There's a sort of... that's like in a box set, kind of just one more. What happens next?
For sure. They definitely changed my password. Now I am responsible with it. And so I have my password back. I've been permitted if I wish. But I understand that it's not my role to peruse what people are saying about me.
Yourself?
No way. God, no.
That way, absolute madness.
Thank you.
Have you done that in the past? Have you fallen down rabbit holes of self-hatred?
Of course.
Right.
But I learned from that. That was punishing.
It's brutal.
Bad.
I mean, it's a brutal time in social media.
So I don't, as long as I keep a separation, I think I can live.
So how many times a day are you checking your phone to see what's happening?
Just constantly. No, I haven't. I don't have it with me right now. So I won't. I truly don't know what's happening today. I imagine a lot of terrible things.
But does that make you twitchy?
No, because we don't have a show this week. So I actually can take a little.
So you can breathe.
I can breathe a little bit. Because, you know, often we'll have a show ready to go, and then something will change in the news that is a complete pivot off of what we wanted to talk about.
Well, if Hillary had won, what do you think you'd be doing shows about?
What a bad president she is. No, I mean, we would have tons of funny material about her. It would be slightly more challenging, I will give you that, but she's an imperfect person and a wonky weirdo, so there would have been tons to talk about with her. And of course, there's a whole broad world out there that we could be.
Do you think that's why she lost? Do you think it was her? Do you think Hillary just wasn't the right person, or do you think the world was just in this populist crazy?
I think this populist fever. I think not quite enough people voted, and we have the electoral colleges, and we have gerrymandering, and we have like a lot of different features to the electoral system that all kind of misfired all at once.
Yeah.
So listen, being on TV as a TV personality has value here.
Yeah.
They will make you president.
Yeah. Well, listen, when do you start your run?
They will give you the job that you definitely don't want. Yeah. There's no way that he wanted this job.
No. But he's digging in. He doesn't want to give it up.
He's digging in. I mean, yeah, whatever.
Are you running out of new names for Donald Trump, or does that the gift
that
keeps on giving?
That's the gift that we just keep an ongoing Google Doc.
You do?
Yeah.
You can just dip into it anytime.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I particularly liked Hateful Vortex of Hot Tub Gonorrhea.
Isn't
that was
nice?
Beautifully
it's
crafted.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
It's so apt.
Do you have writers that are particularly good at that?
Do you have
the go-to name guys?
For sure.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, we have Google Docs on numerous figures, I would say. I think we have one. I'm sure we still have an ongoing one for Ted Cruz.
Sure.
Yes, he is terrific.
He's a hilarious figure.
He's wonderful.
Yeah. They're all hilarious figures, were they not so powerful?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's very dense writing, though, isn't it? I mean, there's a lot of jokes, and there's a lot of material getting burned up very fast.
It goes fast, yeah. We only have 21. I mean, the show's only 21 minutes long.
Yeah, but you talk for most of those minutes.
I do.
Yeah.
I know. It's probably very annoying. I do speak very quickly. I like to get to it.
Yeah, which is great. But that must give you a kind of quality control challenge, just being over all those words. I mean, that's...
Well, we always write the show really fat.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
Yeah. And then we're trying to squeeze it into 21 minutes. So we go in with the intention that we'll just, like, we'll start with too much material and then we'll just squeeze it to fit perfectly.
It does feel like you personally are very connected to the things you talk about.
Yes. The whole show has to be real. Right. I can honestly say that I'm not in this business to just be, because I just want to be a performer doing a comedy show.
Right.
It's really super intentional. And when I don't want to do it anymore, I will stop.
Right. So you are a crusader as well.
I guess that's part
of what you're doing.
I think, you know, when I started this, I don't even know how, I'm turning 50 this year. So whatever age I was when we started the 40s, I don't know. I don't remember. But I thought for sure that we would get canceled after 6 episodes, because I thought, like, who will ever watch this show with this angry lady who nobody's ever seen before doing all this fast material? Like, nobody's going to want this. So let's just do it.
Uh-huh.
Let's just fire ourselves out of a cannon and do a show for 6 great hot episodes.
Right.
And then we'll just always know that we had this project that we really loved and we felt great about it, and we left it all on the floor and we walked away.
Yeah.
And so I kind of, in a weird way, see every show like that. I think that's just part of the process. I need to love the material. I need to care about the thing, or there's no point in doing it.
Do you have to keep checking yourself then? Because I would imagine if you get so moved by things, mm-hmm. so furious about things.
Yeah.
Do you have to keep going, hang on, we're forgetting to be funny as well?
Yes, for sure. Right. It's always a balance. It happens. You know, sometimes the show topples over into something that is not funny and then it's just strident and I'm sort of a mess. And so that doesn't work. But, you know, it's like it's an experiment too. I understand when we've strayed too far and we need to...
Right.
And I know that I should have not done it, or I should have pulled it back a little bit because it dove into the precipice and just wasn't funny anymore and was just too much for everyone.
So do you spend a bit of Thursday going back on the show from the night before?
And
you
don't? Never. No, I don't.
Cancel and continue.
I'm very blessed by not being too self-reflective. I don't care that much. Like, it's good because another show comes so rapidly, it's almost becomes like triage.
Mm.
So... there isn't a lot of time on Thursday to think, oh, I wish that I'd thought more clearly about that.
Right.
It's more a feeling that occasionally wakes me up in the night and I think, oh, okay, fine. I get the message, universe, okay, fine.
Right.
But in terms of making the show happen, you always have to be kind of thinking, what's the next thing? You can't celebrate yourself too much and you can't lament your non-successes too much. It's just, it's always moving, which is how I like it. I don't want to sit around and worry too much.
Well, talking of worry.
Yeah.
I did a bit for your show from a car park in Dorset.
Yes.
This was in June 2016.
That's right.
Donald Trump had visited Turnberry.
Yes.
Just before the election. Mm-hmm. And the Scottish people, as was their wont, tweeted about him, and yes. He was described as a ludicrous tangerine ball bag, a toupee fuck trumpet, etc., etc.
Yeah.
And I read these out for you.
It was so funny.
Which I was delighted to be able to do. I didn't think anything more about it, other than I was very honoured to be involved. The next time I flew to America, he'd become president.
Oh.
And I got pulled aside.
Oh, you did.
And they
not.
Went through my suitcase, and I got extra screening, and. The next time I flew to America was with my family. My son got taken out of line, went through his suitcase. And I, for a second, thought, hang on, this is chilling. This can only be. Right. I went straight to paranoia.
Sure.
This can only be. There are, of course, all the security people are going, it's random. But if something comes up on your boarding pass, it's like a four S's or something.
Okay.
S-S-S-S.
Oh,
I think it's four S's. Was it four S's?
That's good.
And it comes up on your boarding pass, and that means you're... And there's a sort of a few on each flight it happens to. No, it hasn't happened since. Maybe it was. Maybe it was nothing. Maybe
you were like,
was...
I shouldn't have called him a fuck trumpet.
Well, I did sort of think,
oh no.
Is this the world we're in now?
Sure.
And do you ever have moments, because these are powerful people, that you are calling a fuck trumpet on television?
Sure.
Do you ever have pause and going, is this wise?
I do.
Right.
And I think I have good reason to, because I do. They are very vindictive. And I do think that, it's funny that you ask me this question, because I actually was speaking to someone today and I really can't say what the circumstances are. I'm not at liberty to say, but I do think that they actually use their levers of power in a totally inappropriate way.
Right.
And that they would not hesitate to do so. I just think that they're poorly organized and that we all benefit from that in the end.
Right,
and if we just ride this out, they will not get it together to be too punitive. But if they could, they for sure would. I truly believe that. Alana Harkin, who was a correspondent on this show, was pulled aside at Customs and they spoke to her about the show and made her stand there while they were very extremely unpleasant about it at the border. For sure.
And
it
does
happens.
That make but does that make you more determined to speak truth to power, or does it?
Well, it doesn't stop. Yeah,
doesn't
no,
stop
it doesn't
do.
Stop. I mean, this is what we do. This is what we do. We won't do it forever, but this is what we do for now, and this is our job. And
presumably, you have lawyers and you have people checking that you're on the right
Everything
side.
Everything is. You always have to be on the right side of the legalities of things, for sure.
Yeah,
we're very careful.
Does that often limit what you do? Do you think, no, I want to be able to say this or do this or?
Oh yeah, we always rail against it. I mean, but there are certain things we've tried to get. I mean, we fight over the strangest things in standards and practices. We had a whole thing where we were showing a baby rhino being born. Was it like an elephant birth out of a giant elephant's vagina? And I think that we had trouble passing that through standards and practices.
Oh,
so
that's what you have trouble with.
Yeah, this is what we have trouble with. Elephants, vaginas, and things come up every week on the show that we are not permitted to do. And we kind of, we know, we've put it in, but you can't mention, you know, there are certain things that you can't do. It's very few.
Do you have quite a good sense of when you're right on the edge?
We have a very good sense. And even now, we have such a good sense of it that even still we'll leave something in a script and we'll be like, this will never pass legal. In a million years, but let's just say it out loud in rehearsal and love it.
Right. Do you sometimes do something in the studio just to hear the audience react and then know that you have to take out?
We never do it for the audience, but sometimes I often do stuff in the studio just for, we'd have a rehearsal early in the day. And
oh, I see.
We'll often try material in a just big empty room.
Just for the exorcism of it.
To purge it and to think, okay, how does this sound in a big space? Because it sounds really funny when we're all reading it in a tight circle, but how does it sound when you project it across loudspeakers in a big open space? And lots of times you go, no.
Right.
No, we're not going to, can't do that.
Did you always have a sense growing up, were you always connected to the world and current affairs? And
I would say so, yes. I didn't think that it was going to be my job.
Okay.
I had no way would I have ever thought it would be a job for me. But it was just a kind of a thing growing up. And my grandmother, we would watch television on Sunday nights. We always watched 60 Minutes. So proper investigative journalism was just something that I always really loved.
And
I really, really loved and responded to it even as a kid. And so that continued through my whole life.
So how different is Ontario to New York? You grew up in Ontario.
I did. I grew up in Toronto. It's completely different. I love it here. I'm a dual citizen of two nations now. I love it here. My children were born here.
So when you were, did America always seem like where you wanted to end up? Did
no,
it feel like
not
the big
at
shiny?
All. No. It was not a grand ambition of mine. It seemed like a natural progression, but it seemed vaguely impossible. And Toronto has a pretty robust performing arts industry, so I thought that I would stay there. This was an interesting development in my life. I guess when I came here, when I first came to New York, I thought, oh, I'll live here one day. And then I put that thought in a little tiny box in my heart, and I never thought about it again. And then when I moved here, I went, oh, my God, I called it when I was 20.
This seems to be a theme. You're like with Trump. You kind of knew it, and then you forgot about it.
Yes.
You lock it away.
I do. I lock it. I have like a little tiny lockbox.
You should listen
heart.
To that in her voice because it speaks some truth, clearly.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
Hello, I'm La La La, Let Me Explain, and this is It's Not You, It's Them, But It Might Be You. I'm here to answer all your questions around love, relationships, sex, dating dilemmas, and anything else you throw my way. Join me 3 times a week as we work through the depths of this intimacy pool together. From Sony Music Entertainment, listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yes, it does.
So what kind of kid were you?
I was an only child.
Okay.
So I was adult-ish at an early age.
What did your parents do?
My parents, my dad worked in, he was a computer guy, and my mother worked for the government. But I was actually raised by my grandmother quite a bit.
Right.
And she worked at the Catholic school that I attended.
Were you religious?
I was for the early-ish part of my life.
Did you want to be a nun?
I never wanted to be a nun.
Never?
Never. But it's I not did too late, want to marry Jesus, which I guess is being a nun in some ways.
I suppose a sort of dirty nun.
Sort of
sexy nun.
Sexy nun.
Yeah.
I loved Jesus for sure. But in my brain, Jesus was like Kenny Loggins. He was cool.
Okay.
He was not serious. He got it. You know what I mean? And then, after eighth grade, transitioned out of Catholic school, and I thought, that actually is not for me.
Okay.
So we're all set.
Right.
That was a good experience. Great education. Thank you so much.
But now I'll just focus on Kenny Loggins.
Thank you. Now I am free to go after what I want in life.
Right.
In the Loggins.
In the Loggins sphere.
Yeah. I think I was serious. I was studious for sure.
Definitely
like Catholic gold star. Always, I'm still always looking for that gold star.
Okay. So you were clever. I mean, you did well in your exams.
I did.
Were you making people laugh then?
I was, but quietly. Not like, okay. I'm not a class clown. I'm not.
Not at all.
Not extrovert. Not in the least. No. Total introvert. Very.
Really?
I know I'm not, I don't seem shy to you right now, but this is my, I understand microphone stuff. Like, yeah. I get it. And yeah. I'm so happy to be meeting you.
Yeah.
But normally, I'm really quiet. I'm always the quietest person in the room. I just don't electrify rooms. No one would ever. I took my daughter away for her 13th birthday. We stayed at a big hotel full of people. Uh-huh. In no world would anybody in that hotel, the entire people's sphere of the hotel, would anyone think that chick's on TV? There's no way.
Right.
It's like normal,
right.
Low-key, quiet jokes.
Okay. You could recognize the power of being funny, but you weren't kind of.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I like to subvert things, but in a small circle of people. I was a fan of comedy.
Right.
I watched tons of comedy.
Who were you loving as a kid? Who were you?
I loved Carol Burnett, and I loved Lucille Ball,
sure.
And I loved SCTV, and I loved Monty Python.
Right.
I've probably seen The Life of Brian more than any other single movie.
Right. Right.
You know, those things were all, I loved sketch. I watched SNL. It just was, I just loved it.
And did you know then that's what you wanted to do?
No.
Right.
I went through a whole bunch of different career ideas. I thought I'd be an attorney one day. Nobody in my family ever went to college. And so I did, of course. And I thought, well, what do you do when you go to college? You become an attorney, I guess.
And you were clever enough. You could have done
that. I could have done it. And sure. I thought, and then right at the end, right at the beginning of the process where you would take the exam to get into law school, I thought, well, I'll just take a theater class and see. That'll be easy. And it just completely changed all of my ambitions. My family was so horrified.
Got it.
God damn it. Please. Because
yeah. You went to university in Montreal.
I did.
And then transferred to Ottawa, right?
Yes, I did.
So then you start performing at university.
I started there. And
right.
Then I thought, this is what I will be a fine, I will be a wonderful, I will be a great actress.
A great classical
I will
actress.
Be a classical
okay.
actress. I will play Lady Macbeth.
Right.
I will wow the crowds at the Stratford Festival. This is my ambition. And every time I performed things, people would laugh. Oh, yeah, this is so horrible. The universe actually told
you mean
me
you were trying
what,
to be. Desperately serious.
Oh, desperately serious for a long time. And no one ever hired me for anything. I usually think I'm pretty good, not bad, but it's not how the world sees. My face does too much. I'm too in my body. I do too much with my face. You know, it's not.
So what were the parts you were doing at university that made you feel like you could be?
Oh, what did I do? I did like a lot of Sam Shepard and
okay.
I did Tom Stoppard and I really loved all of that.
Right.
I mean, I guess that was comedic.
Right.
So that made a lot of sense. But I thought that I would leave. You know, everybody tells you you're so great in theater school. Everybody loves you in theater school. And then you go out into the real world and you just join this huge ocean of other similarly talented people and it's very hard to get work. So I really didn't find myself, I think, as a performer until I started doing comedy just for the love of comedy.
So in university, you'd stand up and things like that. You weren't even considering?
Not even considering comedy, not at all. I thought that I would become a very serious actress. And that's really what I wanted to do. I left theater school, did not work. It was tragic. It was really such a come down from the experience of being in school, which was so fun and invigorating. And it was a very difficult period of time. And then I started doing comedy just because I like comedy. I mean, really, people in my life forced me to do it.
So like a hobby rather than...
Just as a hobby.
Yeah.
And that doing comedy as a hobby opened up a whole world for me because I started getting work. I actually started just working I became a working actor because I had something that I truly loved in my life. And so I didn't care. You know, I would come to auditions and be relaxed because I was fulfilling my need
right.
to be a performer. I was very fulfilled in one area of my life, so I didn't care about any of the other stuff. And so sad, but as soon as you stop caring about getting work,
everyone wants to give you jobs,
sure. which is what happened.
Sure.
So it's awful because I meet young actors now and I'm like, well, all you have to do is not care at all if anyone hires you.
The easiest thing,
the easiest thing in the world. Just slip it up.
Was there a moment when you were heartbroken and you thought, I'm not going to be Glenda Jackson?
Definitely. Oh my gosh, for sure. I was about to, I was actually on the precipice of quitting performing entirely.
Right.
I thought I'll still do comedy because I love, just because I love it and because I find it very fulfilling, but I need to make more money. Like I need sure. to have, I want to have a life. I was married by then. We had bought a house. We had a nice setup, but I did know that I wanted more out of life. I wanted to be able to pay for my house and eat and think I had ambitions outside of being an impoverished
and your husband was a performer too.
Mm-hmm.
What was he doing better than you?
He was, yeah. Okay. He was. He's very handsome.
Sure. I've seen pictures. Yeah, I've seen him on the TV.
Handsome jobs. And so I thought, oh, I'll give up acting and then I'll do comedy just for fun and just because I enjoy it. And then I got hired by The Daily Show, my last audition that I thought, this will be my last professional audition. The best audition of my life for sure, because I loved The Daily Show.
Yeah.
They came to Toronto. That was very random.
Oh, they came to you?
They came to my city. Uh-huh. I thought, this is my chance to do the best possible version of myself, to just... This is my last, I'll go out with a bang. This will be my greatest audition. I won't get the job. That's ridiculous. But I want to walk away from that experience feeling like I couldn't have left it anymore on the floor.
Yeah.
I couldn't have done a better job, and I did. And then they hired me, and then everything changed.
What is an audition for The Daily Show? What do they make you
it
do?
It was so easy. It actually was not at all a reflection of what they have a very skewed audition process, uh-huh. which I'm very grateful for in retrospect. They really just had me read a script that they had done on the show that I had seen as a fan of the show. I knew the segment. I had seen the segment a couple of times, actually, in rerun. And so when I came to perform the script that I had already seen Stephen Colbert do,
So it's a bit the show.
Yeah, it was just like they had
show.
Already done it. It was a bit that was already in the show. It was just a stand-up. I think it was related to, we had a SARS outbreak in Toronto.
Right.
I think it was about the SARS outbreak. And so I was really familiar with
like
the material.
Like a piece to camera?
A piece to camera. It was so easy. It was the easiest audition.
And why were you so good? What did you
I knew the show. People who were auditioning beside me did not know it, but I knew it because I was obsessed with it. I loved it. It was my favorite show that I would make great sacrifices in my life to make sure I never missed an episode because I loved it. And so I knew it, and everybody else showed up with like their hat collection, and they were like, which hat should I wear? I was like, oh, the cowboy hat. I don't know.
Yeah, right.
I just knew.
So everyone else came to audition for SNL, basically.
Sure.
And
I knew the material. Knew what the thing was. I knew the material. I knew the tone. I really did understand
the show.
That
was the whole process?
Yeah. Ridiculous.
It feels like they weren't taking it very seriously. Not that they didn't choose correctly. Don't get me wrong.
They chose perfectly. No, but they did not understand how to properly audition people, which, again, I benefited from greatly. Because
They had to bring someone back from Canada or...
They didn't, but they were really looking for a woman. They had a really hard time retaining female talent at that show, and they were out of ideas. You know, can I be honest? They just wanted someone who looked like, who understood the show, but looked like, oh, this is so bad, but who looked a little bit busted. Like, you have been in this business, who had like a look of like weariness, who understood the material, but also looked like a journalist who'd been around the block.
You're saying you got the joke because you looked a little tired.
I think so. I think there was a weariness or a worldliness, a world weariness that I brought to it because I was world weary and giving up on my career. So it had that proper chemistry.
So how long ago, what age were you?
I was 33.
Okay.
I was 33. Yeah.
Right. And ready to chuck it all in.
Ready to chuck it. It was my Jesus year, 33.
Right.
So, yeah, I was ready to check it for sure.
And you're already married. You don't have kids yet.
We did not have children yet, right. No.
But you both moved to New York?
We did. Well, Jason stayed a little bit longer because we both for sure thought I was going to get fired. And so, you know, all those Canada conversations that you have, I was like, okay, here's the deal. And he was like, I'm reading your mind. I'm keeping the house. Right. We'll make sure that it's solid before we make any crazy moves. And so I moved without him. He kept the house going. And then I was going back and forth for 6 months to a year, really trying to. And then once it seemed like we were in a good place, he permanently moved out too. It was really, it was very hard. I didn't know anybody here. I did not know a single soul. So I wandered around by myself a lot.
Did you just go like a little apartment somewhere?
I just got a little studio near the studio because I didn't even know.
Where else would you
the
go?
The city, really. Yeah. So I lived really close to the studio, and I just honestly walked back and forth to work. I just worked and kept my nose to the grindstone.
Was it everything you hoped? Did you love it, or was it a bit? Did you feel a little bit lost?
I was lost. You know, it's with any when you join a cast and crew that is a well-oiled machine and very well established. It's very intimidating. It's insane to be just this lady from Canada who does a little bit of comedy on the side to suddenly being in a studio with people who you consider to be titans of comedy and people who you've admired forever. It takes a minute to catch up to that.
Were you a bit starstruck amongst
them? For sure. It took me a long time to catch up to the fact that I got the job. I would say I didn't feel comfortable really for probably 2 years.
Right.
I faked it. I thought, okay, I understand. I just have to fake it until I make it.
Right.
And then I did.
So on The Daily Show, you developed this sort of this niche of the doing the awkward interview, didn't you? You would sort of, you'd ask the unaskable questions to people, usually to highlight some kind of hypocrisy or double standard or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is quite a ballsy thing to have to do.
It is.
Did you have to develop that persona? Because you've described yourself as quite shy.
Yes.
And yet that's very much the opposite of what is required.
It is. But I'll tell you what, you know what it relates back to is being a gold star student and a good Catholic schoolgirl and knowing what the job is.
Okay.
And so I just understood that I could get through it faster and bring home the right interview if I just did the hard work in that moment. Like, I just understood what the job was. I understood what my role was. And I was fine with it. So
you never had the fear of,
I always had the fear. I was always really nervous. You feel it in the pit of your stomach. But I think that when you're interviewing someone who has some power over other people and is misusing their power over other people in some way, then when you're feeling the tension in your body is the exact time to step on the gas.
Right.
And I got that.
So it was a sense of moral righteousness that got you through.
Yeah. Right. I understood. The show changed too. The show evolved over time. When I first started there, it was already evolving when I got there, but I was really a part of the evolution into just more serious material. In the early days, they had more fun with people who were not maybe at full capacity. You know what I mean? There was the tone was really different, and I arrived there just as that was changing, and we're kind of thinking more broadly about the role that we wanted to play in the world. And I was part of the transition where we really kind of stopped punching down and started punching up.
The Daily Show, in the years that you were on it particularly, it was hugely important and arguably created a type of TV show.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly created a type of performer like yourself.
For sure.
Like,
I mean,
John Oliver, Stephen Colbert.
Well, Stephen Colbert, really, I think he is really the originator of the kind of serious correspondent, wry person. I mean, that really, you know, at The Daily Show, we were all kind of doing a Stephen Colbert impression, at least when we started out.
So do you think without that, you wouldn't have ended up here?
It definitely opened up this world.
And you think it was Stephen Colbert more than Jon Stewart that was the
It was there. I mean, obviously it was Jon, but Stephen really kind of created the character of the correspondent.
Jon's
the host. Yes, that's different.
Yes,
but Stephen really created the character that I was playing.
Right.
If that makes any sense. And there,
he was in character, though, wasn't he? Whereas you were more of a version of yourself.
Well,
is that fair? Or did you feel like you were quite...
I felt like I was
quite deep in character.
Pretty deep in character. Pretty deep in character. Yeah. At least for the first half century that I was there. At least for the first, for many, many years, I felt like I was pretty deeply in character. And then it began to evolve more into...
Because you got braver.
It got a little... Was it? Just allowed myself to be a little more personal with it. Like, it didn't have to... You know, one thing that we did there that we really don't do here is have that just a kind of like a wry misunderstanding of the facts.
Mm.
It's much more from the heart here.
Okay.
And that is something that evolved really over time with me, to just like lean into the things I think are important. I don't have to put a spin on them. Mm. I don't have to pretend that I feel one way in order to illuminate that I feel a completely different way.
Right.
Like, I can just drop into it
okay.
now.
Yeah.
But that was a long process. You know, at first there was a pretty wide distance between me and that character, for sure.
So Jon Stewart presented that show for 16 years. Could you see yourself doing Full Frontal for 16 years?
No.
No?
Oh, God, no. Oh, my God, no. Oh, no. I don't know. I don't think so. I don't know what the future holds. I don't see that. I don't see that. We're going into season 4. If you told me I was still going to be doing this when I turned 62, I think not. I don't think so. I don't think any human should want that.
And why not? Just because of the relentlessness of it?
I think I want to live a happy life free of the news cycle at some point. I don't know when. We'll see.
Does it feel like it takes a toll on your
It does take a toll, for sure. Mm. It takes a toll. It takes a toll on all of us.
Mm.
Yeah.
I read an interview with you where you said you just don't have time ever to see the latest movie or the latest TV show or read a book. So does that feel like a sacrifice that at some point you'd like to...
You'd like to
get back to the real world.
Well, we had 3 weeks off. We had a long break over the holidays, and it was so restorative, and I read books, and I did watch movies, and I baked bread, and I did all these things that I actually really like to do.
Right.
I made all these dinners. It was great.
Yeah.
So I've remembered what life was like.
Okay.
Before.
So you're not a workaholic?
Not at all.
No.
I like to do varied things. I like to do lots of different things, but I don't think that I need to. I definitely am not a 12-hour-a-day person who just wants to constantly. No. Not at all. And I've got kids. Like, my kids are little. I like them.
Yeah.
I like to be with them. We enjoy each other. Yeah. I make them breakfast. I want to be in their...
So how do you find that kind of balance between...
I don't think there's any balance. I think I do a really poor job of it. It's really bad, and it's really bad for my health. But basically, I do this job, and I parent my kids, and there is no room for anything else. Like, definitely, there's nothing left of me.
Yeah.
Because I take both things very seriously, and I take parenting more seriously, actually. I'm such a nerd. But... you know, so if I'm not doing that part with my kids and my family, I'm not even human. So they shame me every day. There's like, it's so humbling and great to be with them. It's just, I need it every single day. Mm. So there's no balance. There's no like, hey, let's watch a movie at 11 o'clock at night. I mean, I don't
know.
That's not something that I recognize, but it's okay.
Do your kids get that? Do they get...
No.
Or are they just furious that you're going away all the time to work?
They're just furious. They think they have it really rough.
Right.
I have to go to California. I have to go to California in 2 weeks for one day. And then I'm taking a red eye so I can be back Friday morning. And they are very furious at
furious
me.
Furious you.
They're just like, you're never here.
Right.
You never do anything for us.
Yeah. Oh.
And it's so
So is guilt a big engine because of that for you?
No, I don't feel guilty at all.
Do you not?
No, because I'm always there. They're wrong.
They're factually incorrect.
They're factually incorrect.
Okay.
I do all of the shittiest work of parenting. I'm picking their laundry off the floor. I'm doing like all that super hard work.
Yeah.
I do it all. So I don't feel guilty at all because I'm doing it.
Right.
They're
That's
wrong.
Good though. It's good to know, especially a Catholic child to not be, not have guilt as an engine. It's quite rare.
They'll understand.
It?
When they have their own kids, they'll go, oh, she did.
That's a long way off.
Yeah, she was in there. She was in the mix.
But currently you're spending all your days getting very worked up about how badly the country is run.
It's terrible.
Is there any point where you feel, do you know what? I need to sort it out.
Oh, no.
But why not? You've got the skills, surely. No. You can think fast. You can talk. You understand the issues.
I'm a curator.
Don't you have a duty?
No. I am a curator of others. I think like I have good ideas for other people, but this is my work. This is my area.
You don't think you'd be
this
good at
it? This is where I... No, I think I would not be good at it because I actually think that's a much harder job than what I do. And I'm not a workaholic, as stated. I don't want that.
Yeah.
That sounds terrible. But I appreciate the good work of others, and I'm happy to give them ideas if they're looking for ideas.
Right. So you would contribute to a campaign.
I'm happy
you just
to
don't
contribute.
Want to be in the middle
of it. Just not. This is what I do. This is my sliver of a world. Not so many people can do this, so I'll do this while I wish to do it.
And what is that job? Is it to be entertaining principally, or is it to be like the fool in King Lear who tells truth to power?
Well, I think it's principally to be entertaining. I hope it's entertaining. And then the second part of that is to just speak truth.
Yeah. And do you feel like satire has a power, or does it always feel a little bit like...
I don't think it has so much. Well, I'm not sure if it has a ton of power. I don't know that it does, but I do think that it has the... I do think that it has the power of catharsis. I do think that people benefit from knowing that somewhere out there, there's someone who shares a point of view. I think that's beneficial.
Yeah.
I think people go... They just get so tense. They just... get so bound up. And so it is beneficial to have someone say it all and be rude about it and be an asshole on TV. And then everyone goes, yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
There's something to that. I don't know that there's so much more than that. But
and as it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and you get noticed more and more, do you feel ever more responsibility to be right, to get it right?
I always feel the responsibility to get it right, to get my facts straight for sure. I don't think I always nail it, but I try. You know, we had our own scandal with the whole Ivanka thing earlier in the spring or whenever that happened. And that was a real learning curve for me. I never thought of the show as being watched by anything other than 10 people. Like, I didn't...
You called it, just for anyone who doesn't know, you called Ivanka a feckless cunt.
I did.
And that was not received particularly well by every corner of the chattering classes.
It was not. And so I think that I learned a valuable lesson during that episode. But the lesson that I learned was, this is a show that is watched by people. Like you have, this is a platform. So how do you want to use this platform going forward? Like it's.
Were you annoyed though that they got to.
Of course. It was so annoying.
Yeah.
It still annoys me.
But you did apologize.
I did because I felt terrible that the story that we were trying to tell, which was about migrant children, it was the first time that we had ever touched on the story of child separation. It went largely ignored. I mean, I can't even count the number of news agencies with their kind of like faux concern. The narrative was very much within news circles. What an unfortunate choice of words. It's too bad that we've all become so distracted and we can't focus on the content of the story, which I guess was maybe about migrant children or something like that. And I was like, well, now's your chance.
Yeah.
Now you do it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, it was unfortunate that what we were trying to say was completely consumed by this media frenzy over a word.
But that wasn't your fault.
It wasn't my fault at all.
So
that's up to them.
Did you have it? Was there a debate about how you deal with that? Or did it just feel we've got to apologize to get in front of this? Or
I did it because I was regretful that we did divert attention from something that, because in the end, they pulled the segment, no one could see it because of that. And then I felt like I just really had done a disservice to, viewers of the show who for whom it's a very sensitive word. It's not a sensitive word to me, but fine.
Yeah.
And I felt like we did a disservice to the really valuable and really good segment that we had shot that was the 8 minutes preceding this one thing that came at the end. And so it was completely erased from the world, and that made me feel very badly. But we've made up for it since then.
Sure. At moments like that, are you kind of, when there's a sense of crisis in the workplace, does that sort of energize you, or do you just want to sort of hide under a desk for a minute?
Well, you always want to hide under a desk, but I am like running a big team of people.
Would you sort of naturally just be under a desk sort of hiding most of the day?
Oh, for sure. I would be if I could be, but I can't be because there's 65 people here whose jobs and lives depend on me being a human person.
Yeah.
And so it's then it sometimes it's an act. Sometimes it's just the best acting job of your life. Mm. Sometimes it's an Emmy Award winning performance of leader of 65 people.
Yes.
Who really didn't want to come to work today, but who has to stand in front of the entire staff and go, nobody panic. We all still probably have jobs.
Yeah.
Let me see what happens by the end of today, but I'll keep you all informed as things happen.
But that's for the shy girl who then has to go and, you know, sort of deal with the executives and calm everyone down and, mm-hmm. I don't know, construct a statement or whatever it is you have to do in moments like that. Is that all, do you have to keep taking deep breaths or do you find a sort of, is there
you
part of you that
it.
Just starts? It's just part.
This is just a part that's. This is just. I think just from experience and age, there's just a part of you that starts moving. Like you understand what needs to happen. You understand what the end result has to be, and you just power through to get to that end result. And then you know that on Saturday you can take a breath and go, "What just happened? What in the world? What in the hell did I just experience?"
Yeah.
And then you can. There'll be time in the future to break it all down.
Yeah.
But now is the time to be strong.
And when you do look forward into the future, do you worry that you'll get mellow? Do you worry that the anger will go, that you'll...
That would be nice. I'm not worried about it because it's not something
There's no end to the anger.
There's no end. But also it's not a frame of mind that I live in from moment to moment.
Okay.
I'm actually a pretty happy... That's so dorky. I'm actually a pretty happy and content person, so... When I'm called to be angry and called to like tap into all of that and I'm reading the news and of course it's aggravating, that's one thing. But when I'm not, I'm very conscious about separating myself from that. So it's not the substance of my life. When I go to the store, I'm not raging. It's not like, it's not as much a part of my life as I think people would imagine it to be. I'm not really mad in my personal life much at all.
But you don't think you'll finish your life playing Miss Prism in The Importance of Being Earnest back at Stratford?
Well, everyone would be very lucky if I did.
I would like
really
to see it.
Be good at it.
Yeah.
But fine.
That's not where you're headed. You're not returning to acting.
I don't think I'm returning to... No, I don't think so. Just watch. I'll slide into early dementia and then I'll just start putting plays up in my apartment. And with 10 chairs.
Yeah.
And you'll have to be in attendance and you'll critique me.
Yeah. It was very good, Samantha. You did very well.
Thank you. Yeah. I knew it. Nailed it. I'll be very arrogant about my performance for sure.
Samantha, thank you. I know you've got a show to put on. I very much appreciate you spending some time.
This was so much fun.
It was so good that you joined in. Thank you.
This is such a great pleasure. Thank you.
For me.
No, for me.
Oh, shucks.
Stop it. Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
It was really fun. I'm sweating.
Are you?
I need to go deep inside. It's a lot of self-reflection.
David Tennant Does a Podcast With is a Something Else and No Mystery production. Produced and edited by James Deacon. Additional production from Chris Skinner, Steve Ackerman, Sarah Camlett, Josh Gibbs, Tom Koenig, Joel Freeman, and Georgia Tennant. Next time.
What would it take? Princess Leia.
Princess Leia, yeah.
You'd do Princess Leia?
I would. I want that out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've not had any call from any of the various Star Wars franchises.
No.
I'm sure it's going to happen.
Also from Something Else.
Out to Lunch with Jay Rayner. Join Britain's biggest food critic for juicy conversations over lunch with top names in music, film, TV and comedy. Guests include Dermot O'Leary, Grayson Perry, Aisling Bea, and Jamie Cullum.
There was this girl I was dating at the time who it wasn't going so well with, and we'd kind of broken up, and she managed to turn up at the second set and, shall we say, had a lot to drink.
Heckle you?
If heckling involves trying to take my shirt off whilst I'm singing...
Listen now in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all good podcast apps.